Hello, old friend. Welcome to Best of the Rest, the show where we take a second look at superhero movies that were poorly received upon release, but only talk about the things we like and what the movie does well. It's sometimes a challenge, but always a good time. And this week, we are talking Dark Phoenix. My name is Chris Logan, and I am joined, as always, by the man with a cosmic comic book recall ability, Andrew Williams. Welcome, Andrew. How are you doing today? And try to say that nickname three times fast.
Okay. Chris, I'm good. I'm excited to talk about this one. I don't know if I've watched this one since it came out, and I saw it in theaters. So
yeah, I saw it in theaters as well. And I think same. I don't think I revisited it until this week when we decided to cover it for the podcast. And it was definitely a fun revisit. I enjoyed it. Sure. Going back to it. Interesting story behind this one. Obviously, it's one of the last X-Men movies released by Fox and the last team movie, probably the last in the main series under that Foxman umbrella. It was released June 7th of 2019. So this is well after Fox was taken over by Disney. So people knew the series was coming to an end, but there's still a lot of money poured into this movie. It had a budget of $200 million. At the box office, it was only able to bring in $252 million, clearing its budget, but nowhere near enough to be considered profitable. Critically, not well received, just a 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, one of the lowest in the series.
Yeah, fans didn't seem to flock back to this kind of Dark Phoenix redux to see if maybe this one was going to get a better shot. I don't know if that was kind of the MCU of it all, where people were like, this really doesn't matter anymore because, you know, the MCU is going to be rebooting the X-Men eventually. I'm sure the reviews didn't help the word of mouth. I think with the marketing budget, the movie ends up losing like $130 million. So it's not a success by pretty much any measure of anyone's imagination.
Yeah, definitely that audience reception. Honestly, I heard this movie getting trashed before it was even released. I went into theaters with very low expectations because I heard nothing positive about it. And people, again, that hadn't even seen the movie were just saying, oh, it has to be awful. It had numerous reshoots, got delayed multiple times for various reasons. Part of which, though, was the test screenings just weren't great. But honestly, that's pretty normal. That happens all the time. But I think this movie was kind of under a microscope because of that Disney acquisition of Fox. And people almost wanted it to fail in a way. It's kind of the exact opposite of what we do on this podcast. People were just anxious to trash the movie before they even saw it.
Right.
And I'll tell you right now, I went into theaters, like I said, very low expectations. The movie definitely exceeded my expectations, and it was not the dumpster fire that the internet told me it was going to be. Now, again, I didn't rewatch the movie until this week, and my thoughts might have evolved a little bit. We're going to jump into it, but I'll say right now, overall, this movie is way better than its reputation, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, I think part of it is definitely there was like, I don't know if I'd come out and say that people like hoped it would fail, but like they were definitely like, we're done with this in a way. I know Kinberg himself didn't exactly have the best track record with a lot of people. I think people wasn't really exciting people by taking over because it kind of felt like he was going to keep things going with the aesthetic they'd established. Kinberg himself had obviously built up a lot of goodwill with Fox with his work on the previous films. That's why he gets the nod here. But I would definitely not, I would not put this at a 22%. I wouldn't have expected that, like after watching it. When I watched it the first time, I don't even really remember what I thought. I think it was kind of just in one ear out the other. Like I finished watching it and I was kind of like, all right, time to move on with my life. But it's something where I definitely feel like there was some pre-existing bias when it came to this one.
I think so for sure. You mentioned Kinberg. The movie is written and directed by Simon Kinberg. Now he was involved with every X-Men movie in one way or another since X-Men 3, where he was a co-writer and adapted the Phoenix storyline for the first time, including he was involved in even Logan and the Deadpools, which would be a great band name.
One day.
And yeah, he even though he hadn't technically directed an X-Men movie before or a movie at all. He had stepped in and completed scenes when other directors were unable to do so. So he definitely had a lot of work, very hands-on. I'd almost kind of compare him to like a Feige for the Foxmen, but even more hands-on than that because he worked with the actors. He was a producer, a writer, an eventual director. He had relationships with everybody involved. And a lot of the actors in the movie, namely Jennifer Lawrence, really petitioned for him to step into that director role whenever the opportunity presented itself. So, yeah, like you said, a lot of goodwill with Fox and a lot of the collaborators in these movies.
Yeah, the stories, I don't know if this has ever really been officially stated or not, but yeah, as you kind of hinted at, the implication seemed to be that during Days of Future Past and X-Men Apocalypse, there were some issues with the chosen director not fulfilling the tasks that were presented in front of him, delaying productions. And apparently in both of those instances, Kinberg was pretty much the saving grace of the films, to the point that people are saying like Days of Future Past was only a success because of Kinberg stepping up and basically finishing that movie. So it's not even really misplaced goodwill, really, because Days of Future Past was a huge success.
Yeah.
So if he's got huge parts of these movies getting to the finish line, then by all means, I can absolutely see why when it came time to move beyond said people, Kinberg was like first in line as far as Fox and even the cast and crew went, because they're going to have, they're going to see what he's done for them in the past. So,
well, let's jump into the movie that he delivered with this final X-Men entry. During a rescue mission in space, Jean Grey is hit with a mysterious force that is absorbed into her body. Now she is more powerful than ever and has trouble controlling her abilities. After learning that Professor X has been lying about the death of her parents in a car crash, a skirmish ensues with the team that leaves Quicksilver sidelined and Mystique dead. Jean soon finds herself the target of three forces: Magneto and his Brotherhood of Mutants that wish to destroy her, Xavier and the X-Men who want to save her, and the shape-shifting alien race Dabari that want to control her. We get a little bit cosmic in this one, Andrew.
A little bit.
You know, famously, X3, one of the main criticisms, aside from almost sidelining the Dark Phoenix storyline altogether because they focus on some other plot, they kind of strip away all cosmic nature of the story, which is strange to do whenever you're familiar with that original concept, right, of Phoenix.
Because the whole point of the Phoenix Force is that it is this cosmic entity that Jean is just equipped to basically be the host of. That's kind of the whole thing. Now, the original X-Men trilogy basically presents it as that the Phoenix is just already in Jean Grey, essentially. So
he's just very powerful and has been suppressed for most of her life.
Right. So they kind of just bypass that cosmic thing entirely, which, given that Kinberg co-wrote that movie, I could understand why people were maybe hesitant at him coming back to do it again. But yeah, we definitely get a little bit more of that classic Phoenix, at least the setup in this film.
You've got to think in 2019, so far after X3, I mean, the superhero landscape had changed so much, and MCU had gotten weird by this point. You've got Thanos and Guardians and all kinds of cosmic stuff that audiences had no trouble keeping up with. So I'm sure the studio and even Kinberg were probably like, maybe we can get a little bit weird with it with the X-Men, and they do. And I was happy to see it. But before we jump in all those scenes, we of course got to talk about the cast of the movie. And we're going to start with the high point. We want to pick who gives the best performance in the movie and elevates the film to a new level with their work. We like to recognize one actor or actress who does so and give them the Mark Strong Award. Andrew, who gets your Mark Strong Award for Dark Phoenix?
I think this guy has been kind of an underrated addition to the X-Men franchise throughout the course of all of these prequel films. So I'm actually going to give it in this one to Nicholas Holt as Hank McCoy / the Beast.
Yes, man. I'm so glad he said that. I agree 100%. He also gets my Mark Strong Award, surprisingly, because we've praised Michael Fassbender a ton for his performance, and he's still great here. James
is not in it very
still
much.
Great here. Yeah, he's sidelined a lot, but Nicholas Holt, who's, like you said, always been solid, kicks it up just a little bit more. He gets a little bit more to do, and he's fantastic.
He's great. Like you said, Fassbender really kind of sits out the whole first half of this film. He really isn't in it very much. I mean, he ends up being a big part of the second half, but
I took a note of the timestamp. It is 52 minutes when he first comes on screen.
Yeah. So he sits out half this movie almost. I think the movie's like just under 2 hours. So, and his storyline, and once he gets kind of involved in the action, it's really just like set piece after set piece. There's right. not a whole lot of, there's nothing like Apocalypse where like he loses his family again or something like that. Poor man. And in this one enough. Too. And this yeah. one puts something else on him too. It's like, good Lord, just
yeah.
can we just give this man a win for once? But yeah, so, and like I said, McAvoy is great, but like with this one, Hank McCoy gets his personal struggle with Xavier. Obviously, he's got an attachment to Raven and what happens to her. And then his great scene where he like stands up to Charles and is like, no, you need to take ownership of what you're doing and stop pretending that the bad things are just like a byproduct of what you do. You need to understand these are your fault. And it's a great scene, and he's just a great performance. And I think he, like I said, he's been a solid hand and kind of the bedrock of some of these all the way through. But to finally have a couple of big moments to stand out, it definitely gives him the step ahead as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that scene at the dinner table with Xavier that comes to mind right away, where as far as this movie giving him stuff to really sink his teeth into and get emotional, it's after Mystique has died and he just wants Xavier to admit that maybe he made a mistake. Maybe this is his fault. And he can't. Xavier's still trying to give these big swooping speeches and pep talks, but he's like, you know, cut that out, man. Like, people are dying. Like, this is real. And I love that. I love anytime Professor Xavier, you know, he is an idealistic person and he usually doesn't says the right thing, but he's still a human. He's still a person. And anytime those kind of cracks in his philosophy are explored a little bit and get some conflict with the team, I think is always good X-Men storytelling. It's handled really well here. Yeah. Nicholas Holt, fantastic. And as Beast, he looks better than he's ever looked. I think great. I even said on a previous episode that like he just always looked like skinny Beast to me, you yeah. know, like, I mean, it's hard, you know, Kelsey Grammer's Beast was just perfect. So it's yeah. hard to come on after that. And he just looks like kind of like Beast, but skinny and younger. He gets filled out a little bit more. His face looks better. The transformation is cool. This iteration of Beast can kind of transform back and forth, which is not usually what Beast does, but it's fine.
Yeah.
And the effect of the fur coming out and transforming, he can seemingly do it at will now. In previous movies, he needed some kind of like serum to repress it. But
right.
The effects look great. I mean, the movie overall looks awesome. But again, Beast, as good as ever looked. Nicholas Holt did a great job. Yeah. Mark Strong Award for me as well.
Cream of the crop.
Cream of the crop. James McAvoy is Charles Xavier. We're going to talk about him. We already mentioned him. Always great in all of these movies. No oh, yeah. different here. Bald the entire time. For the first time.
Yes.
That's different.
Yeah, it's a big change. Most of this cast, I think literally there's only one person who's like not from a previous film.
I thought you were going to say most of this cast is bald, to be yeah. fair. I'm like, wait.
What? No, not where I'm Are going they? With that. A lot of these people are coming back from Apocalypse, Days of Future Past, but McAvoy, like I said, the last movie kind of gave him the, oh, I'm bald now thing. So now this movie, he sticks with it. Apparently the baldness has stuck. So he's, yeah, I like that this movie takes place in 92 though. And none of these people have aged at all, but yeah.
Look, you know, the movie doesn't really emphasize that time jump as much as it did with really the 70s doesn't. And 80s. It was kind of like, I mean, we're catching up to Patrick Stewart. Like, you can only go so far without getting
these next really 8 weird. Years are going to be rough. But yeah, no, McAvoy is great. He was a really good Charles Xavier pretty much through all of this. He's still a good anchor of everything here. And again, we kind of dive into this idea that Xavier doesn't always have the noblest of intentions, or even his noble intentions take him down an odd, like ends justify the means kind of path. Like with Jean, the idea is suppress everything he can about her trauma, make her think that her parents are dead. Like, he's making these decisions because he thinks it's going to be better for Gene, but then not realizing the greater damage that can cause. So we're getting some good layers to Xavier here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the whole Xavier Magneto dynamic and all the best X-Men stories, we've talked about Magneto a lot. And again, this movie, Michael Fassbender is Eric Lyncher, Magneto. And he's a villain where you like, you don't necessarily agree, but you understand. You're like, okay, I get where you're coming from. I get how someone has been through what you get through, but come away with this philosophy. And it's, you know, it's too extreme for me, but I get it. Xavier's on the other end of that spectrum. It's not that Xavier is all good and perfect and Magneto's too far. They're both a little too far in their given viewpoint. You know, Xavier's optimism can sometimes lead into being naive, or even when he's trying to make the decision for the greater good, he ends up putting himself above everyone else. And if he thinks it's good, he can enforce that on other people. And it's got to be, you know, his idea of the greater good is everybody's idea of the greater good. And that's not the case. So again, I think these movies, I mean, by now they've explored these characters so many times. Kinberg's been around for most of it. He understands what makes these characters work, where the dynamics are. I think he nails the characterization of most of these characters, but especially Xavier and Magneto. And these actors are playing them for the fourth time plus for most of these. So it was just like putting on a glove for them to slide right into the role. I'm imagining Michael Fassbender as good as ever. He still gets to deal with some tragedy because Mystique dies. And they were, of course, very close previous romantic involvement. And even though they hadn't seen each other for a long time, it seems like it puts him on the warpath. Once he learns once he learns Jean Grey is responsible for Mystique's death, he's like, all right, she has to die. I mean, there's no way around it.
Nope. He's obviously, they do a few shades here. They've got him living on, I guess, what is a version of Genosha with his kind of mutant brethren, the Brotherhood, whatever you want to call them. But this idea is, you know, Genosha is basically just like a mutant haven and a very kind of self-sustaining type commune they almost have going on there. But originally, Jean Grey comes to him for help because she knows that she's out of control. And she knows that Magneto has had issues with, you know, rage and his anger in the past. And she's trying to get help. But then she ends up drawing attention to them, which causes a bunch of turmoil. But yeah, Fassbender is, again, the minute he shows up, he owns the screen. He owns the scenes. He's so good. It's unbelievable. Like I said, we mentioned this, I think, with potentially X3 or whatever. But just to have two versions of iconic portrayals from essentially the same franchise by different sets of actors is pretty impressive on its own.
Yeah. I mean, it's
to really do that. Yeah.
It's hard enough for one actor to become so synonymous with the character, but two actors with the same character, it's fantastic. Sophie Turner returns as Jean Grey / the Phoenix, if you want to call her that, and continues to do a good job. I mean, in most of this movie, she is tormented. She's doesn't know her path. It doesn't know the right way to handle these powers. Doesn't know where to go. It makes her very vulnerable whenever she gets sort of under the spell of Dabari? Am I saying that right? Yeah. It looks like this. They went through several different versions of who this alien race would be. Even they were supposed to be Skrulls at one point until a rewrite, but they are shape-shifting aliens. And they know about this force that she has inside of her and they want to use it for their own, I don't know about evil means, but their own purposes.
Right. Yeah. So she's getting pulled in several different directions because she's got her own inner torment. She's got kind of what the Phoenix is telling her to do. Then she gets the Dabari in her ear while also knowing that people are trying to come and kill her. So she's got these, just like I said, she's getting stretched six different ways and she sells that torment pretty well. I mean, Sophie Turner is no lightweight from Game of Thrones and the like, but she does a good job here. I think this casting was particularly on point.
She gets so close to, she's talking about this power she has and she's talking about a lot. She's like, whenever it takes over and I'm waiting for her to be like, I like it. I'm waiting for her to have like that Hulk line, but she just says, yeah, people get hurt. But she almost like kind of gives in to like how good this power is. I didn't quite go there, but kind of toying with that. Ty Sheridan returns as Scott Summers / Cyclops. Now, fully in a relationship with Sophie Turner's character, with Jean Grey, which they had only kind of hinted at before. But at the beginning of this movie, they have that classic setup, that classic dynamic of Scott Summers and Jean Grey as an item. I think he does a great job. Honestly, I don't want this to sound like a backhanded compliment to anybody, but I think this might be my favorite Cyclops, this movie, Ty Sheridan as Cyclops. Now, he never really stood out to me too much before. You know, James Marsden looked great.
Right.
Too much to do, but he gets to have a vulnerable side, be worried about Jean Grey, and then get angry and be vengeful and try to destroy the people that mean her harm. So he gets kind of a wider range than most of the other Cyclops performances. And I think at the end of the day, it might be the best one we've seen.
I think so, because he doesn't, there's still a, because the biggest complaint that Marsden gets as Cyclops is he doesn't feel authoritative at times. He doesn't feel he's like
supposed to be the leader. Yeah.
But he's second fiddle to Wolverine the whole time, which, to be fair, it's Hugh Jackman. But in this one, you can see, because he's not the leader yet, but you see it. Like, you see all the threads, you see the build, you see the foreshadowing. You can see this guy growing into that role. And it's, yeah, like I said, I don't disagree. I actually think it's quite good.
Alexander Shipp returns as Aurora Monroe, also known as Storm. And again, I said it on Apocalypse, I'll say it now. The accent is on point. It sounds great. I think in that episode, I said I wasn't sure if it's her natural accent. I looked into it. It's not. That is 100% acting, baby. And she does a fantastic job. Again, for fear of doing a backhanded compliment, that's something that Halle Berry struggled with. And I think she does it tremendously. And this, you know what? This is my favorite Storm.
I agree. She gets some good stuff in the final action set pieces. And yeah, it's really good.
Evan Peters returns as Peter Maximoff / Quicksilver. Not in the movie a ton. As I mentioned, the synopsis, he gets sidelined in an early fight and then doesn't come back till the very end. But he's part of that rescue in space. He gets some classic Quicksilver lines. He's talking to the students back at the mansion, and he's like, yeah, I pretty much did the whole thing. Typical cocky, young, fun self.
Yeah.
It's great. I mean, this fantastic cast. I wish we had more of them. I got to imagine. Right. You know, you look at this movie, and if you really want to go like behind the scenes, you can kind of, some seams start to show, if you will. A lot of these actors' contracts had expired with the previous movie, so they signed on for one more movie. And people like Evan Peters or even Jennifer Lawrence had certainly grown in popularity and star status. And so you kind of get the feeling that maybe they signed on with the agreement that it'd be a lighter workload, and the script had to work to accommodate that. I think it's handled really well, given, you know, it's so much casting to juggle. I'm glad we get to see him at all, but yeah, not in most of the movie, but always fun when he's on screen.
Yeah, I don't know if this was potentially even conflicts with American Horror Story or things like that, but yeah, he basically is in the first kind of two big set pieces, the space rescue and then kind of the showdown with Jean outside her parents' house. And then he gets sidelined in that fight, and then he's gone the rest of the movie. So we don't see him at all after that. But he's great. He's another one that, like, the minute he was on screen, he slid right into the role, and there was no problem.
Cody Smith McPhee returns as Kurt Wagner, also known as Nightcrawler. And, man, this might be my favorite Nightcrawler now I'm thinking about it. You know, X2 set a high bar with that opening action set piece, and it's fun. It's still great, but I think this actually tops it. You get a lot of good action, and we get to dig into the character a little bit, a little bit, probably more than we ever have. And nothing but good stuff to say about this guy.
Oh yeah. He gets, again, during that final kind of train fight, they do a good job of kind of giving everybody a big moment during that.
Yeah.
And he gets a good one where he kind of like unleashes essentially as much as Nightcrawler can. And it's really well done. So, yeah, he's another one coming back from Apocalypse. But in this one, he gets a bit more to stand on.
We mentioned already, but Jennifer Lawrence is back as Raven / Mystique. Again, not in the movie a ton, but a very important role. She, along with Beast, is starting to question Xavier's motives and whether or not He has the team's best interest in mind versus just his own. She did not agree with that space rescue that Xavier sends them on. She thinks that's too out of their league, putting them in too much danger. And of course, when Xavier tells them that's what they need to do, he's not putting himself in danger. And she calls him out on that. When she dies, she's really not on great terms with Xavier. They never have a chance to make up.
They don't. And so she ends up being in the movie roughly the same amount of time as Quicksilver is. They both get taken out essentially in the same fight. But yeah, this her role in this movie is to kind of develop that tension with Xavier. But like you said, it doesn't get resolved. And that's part of what I think. And then even more so in the initial aftermath of it, Xavier still isn't like admitting his fault. And that leads to that really great scene between Beast and Xavier, where they kind of have that blow up at each other. But she's great. I mean, this is, like I said, the thing with Jennifer Lawrence that we'd heard over the years is that she was kind of didn't quite like the process of being Mystique as much as which, I mean, I can't say I blame her whatsoever. So in this one, I think they found a way to finally get the makeup down to like just her face and her hands.
Imagine Simon was like, look, do one more movie. I promise I'll kill you. You'll never have to come back again.
the old Han Solo.
Jennifer Lawrence just had like a beard in this movie.
just like shows up randomly. But yeah. So, I mean, but yeah, she's been good in all of these. I think she was very much an unexpected hit in these movies, because it definitely doesn't sound like that was necessarily the intention, was for Mystique to become this breakout part of these, but she clearly did. So they brought her back in increasingly bigger roles to the previous films. But in this one, there is this weird, not really weird, but like they do seem to be phasing this to the younger cast in a lot of ways, and taking Lawrence out, I think, should this have continued, would have been a good move to move this to the younger cast as this movie kind of tries to make that shift to them. But yeah, she's great.
And Jessica Chastain is in this movie as the character Vuk.
Vuk. Vuk. I don't know.
Not sure how it's said. It's the UK. She's the alien, though. Well, really, I guess she plays a human on Earth that the alien, who is a shapeshifter, takes the form of, if you want to get technical. The aliens, when they're not shapeshifting, they all look like Groot. They all look like trees walking around. But she's, you know, playing an alien. She's almost has like these, she's off in her performance. She's, you know, not human. I think she does that very well.
Extremely well. Like you can tell, because there's a really good sequence where like I think her name is Margaret or whatever. She's like a human and she's at a party or like a dinner party with a bunch of friends, and she hears the dog outside. So she goes outside, she runs into these aliens, and the alien takes her form. And like just that contrast of when she's at the party and interacting with people, and then when she comes back as the alien and interacts with them, it's night and day. It's completely different. It's body language, it's interactions, it's everything. So fantastic work there.
Fun fact about Jessica Chastain, she is not Bryce Dallas Howard, which I make the mistake of all the time. I watched The Martian and I was like, I recognize her. I was like, oh, it's Bryce Dallas Howard. And then like the credits rolled and I was like, wait, it's not. Andrew, you're looking at me. You do this every time I confuse two people. I'm not alone. You can Google it. A lot of people confuse them. I watch this.
I don't appreciate your implication that all redheads look the same, Chris. It's a little, it's bothering me a little bit.
you kind of like Bryce Dallas Howard, Andrew. I've never told you this before, but
I know I do. I get it all the time.
I was watching this show. So watching this movie with friend of the show, my wife, and she brought that up. She's like, you know, she's like, I'm not going to list these women's ages, but she's like, she's significantly older than Bryce Dallas Howard, but people always make that comparison. So I wonder, I mean, it probably gets annoying to be compared to someone else, but at least she's compared to someone who's like younger. She appreciates that. Most people like that.
Sure.
I'm trying to put a positive spin on this. I don't know. Yeah. It's one of those classic, you know, Kurt Russell, Jeff Bridges situations where everyone's constantly confusing the two of them, Andrew.
I don't think they are. I don't feel like people do that.
I'm not the only one, damn it.
Just because three people do it doesn't mean it's a thing. Anyway.
Let's go back to this movie. It's time to talk about some scenes. Oh, you want to talk about Jessica?
Well, we'll talk about Jessica.
What is there to say other than she looks like this other actress? What? Talk about her performance? How good she is?
it's interesting because this is definitely one of those things that in the movie that apparently was kind of in flux, her character and like what the aliens were going to be. Like you said, at one point it was talking they would potentially be the Skrulls because the Fox was able to use the Skrulls. The idea of using them as the Shi'ar was also talked about. And even Jessica Chastain being Lalandra instead, just being that kind of iconic X-Men character.
Now, who is Lalandra? So explain that for people. So
Lalandra is she's from the Shi'ar Empire, and she actually has like a bond with Xavier. Like they actually get married at one point. And so she's definitely part of the cosmic piece of the X-Men universe. And she would have been a big thing to bring into this. I can kind of understand why they didn't. It's kind of like bringing Adam Warlock into Infinity War with like no build. It's like you're bringing in a character that's got a huge backstory, an immense history with these characters, and you've already got this thing that's kind of stuffed to the gills with everything that has to be happening. So I can understand why they just made them kind of generic aliens instead. The Dabari in the comics do have their planet wiped out by the Phoenix Force. That is a thing. So they do bring that over here, but they basically want to use the Phoenix Force to bring their planet back. But I even think Chastain herself said that this character was kind of like really in flux the whole time. But I think despite that, she gives off, you know, like I said, it's very alien performance. It's one of those things that, like I said, it's just like 1 degree off being human. And she nails that balance just right of making you realize something is not right with you. So, but no, I just wanted to call that out. I thought she did a really good job.
Well, let's talk about this movie, Andrew. Let's talk about the best scenes in the movie. And of course, again, we're going to start at the top with your favorite scene of the movie. Andrew, in your opinion, what's the best scene in Dark Phoenix?
I touched on this a little bit, but I think it's the final train fight. I guess that's not technically the final fight. You have like the Vuk, Jean Grey face off, but like there's this big action set piece following where basically all the X-Men get taken into custody by the government, the military, and they're basically being taken away. And then Vuk and the Dabari come after them to get Jean to finish taking the Phoenix Force. This just leads to a really great bunch of action set pieces where all the X-Men, like I said, kind of get their moment to shine. Everybody gets a big moment to stand up, moments of like self-realization where some of the characters gain a confidence and start showing off their abilities. And I think it's all just really cool. And it's also got stuff where they're working as a team. Like they're actively working with each other. They're helping each other. And all of that just works for me. Like I said, there's some pretty great scenes in this movie, but just seeing like the X-Men going back and forth as a team, doing all their stuff, that was just really cool to see in a way that I don't really feel like we've seen too much in this franchise, ironically enough. So yeah, I was into that.
I agree. My favorite scene in the movie, I think it's the best scene in the movie. And we've agreed on Mark Strong Award, and now we've agreed on best scene. And it's not because there's not a lot of good performances to pick from and not a lot of good scenes. I think this movie is filled with great set pieces that all look fantastic. But undeniably, this climax of the train is just so good. Like I said, each character gets moments to shine from like an emotional standpoint. At this point, Beast is on Magneto's side, and he thinks that they need to kill Jean Grey until there's some Xavier on the train finally admits that he was wrong and that he made mistakes. But Mystique would not want this. She would not want Jean Grey to be killed. And so whenever the Dabari break onto the train to get Jean, now Beast is on the side that we need to save her. And he has just one word, one line that is so good. It summarizes his change and his growth. He just stands up and says, no, like really emphatically, really emotionally. There's just a lot behind it. And it's incredible to get so much emotion out of
one word.
Letters. Yeah. That's it's so good. But beyond that, the action, like I said, everybody gets a moment to shine. We touched on Nightcrawler already, but Nightcrawler's character is, you could really call him a pacifist. He really doesn't want to fight if he doesn't have to. He would rather just be a teenager and hang out, but he's on the team. He'll do what needs to be done. He'll do the rescue missions and he'll fight if he has to. But his focus on the train sequence is to try to save people, even the humans, like the guards. And he tries to save one of them and they get killed right in front of him. And you see like something snap And he just, my notes say like Nightcrawler just goes ham and he just like destroys everybody. I mean, with his ability to teleport and teleport people.
He, oh, yeah.
Pretty powerful. He has to be. And he goes nuts in a scene that rivals that X2 opening action set piece. It's so good. Watching Nightcrawler teleport in these movies never gets old. I love that effect. I love the smoke. I love the sound effect. It is all very good. And yeah, it's team dynamic. They're calling out things they can do to help each other and calling out danger to one another and working together, like you said, as a team. You know, we mentioned this movie doesn't introduce a lot of new characters, a lot of new X-Men, which up until this point, every entry kind of felt like it had to do that. Like we have to bring in new characters. There's so many X-Men. And by the time you get to Apocalypse, I mean, we covered that movie, but one thing it struggles with is how big that cast is and giving time for everybody to shine, which it doesn't do so well. So this movie does not increase. In fact, it decreases the amount of X-Men with some of the sidelining. Yeah. And everyone is better for it. They all get times to shine and it's illustrated so well in that train scene. And then Magneto. I think this might be Magneto's best action scene in any of the movies because he goes nuts, whether it's controlling all of the guns at once or ripping apart the entire train car and crushing it, throwing it to the side. I mean, it is
some cool stuff. So actually, I really like that scene where he's firing all the guns because as they run out of ammo, he just drops them. And I just love that a movie acknowledges that guns run out of ammunition at some point. Like he's not even like reloading them. He's just like, oh, you're empty. Go.
I didn't even notice that detail, but that's awesome.
That scene where he crushes the train, like he gets all the guys in the train car and then just literally like makes a fist and crushes it, tosses it. I was like, that's dope.
Yeah, it's so good. And then at one point, Jean puts everybody like in this force field as everything's getting destroyed and protects them. And that looks really cool. We see those force fields twice in the movie because there's a flashback to her as a young child in the backseat of her parents' car. And the car gets to a car accident, which may have been Jean's fault. And Jean instinctively protects herself with a force field in that scene. And there's, you see in slow motion, like the glass shards coming and bouncing off the force field. It looks super cool. And I like the little bubbles that everybody gets placed in this train sequence. It looks great.
It's just a very well done sequence. And for Kimberg, somebody who's not necessarily the most experienced director, it looks pretty good. So kudos.
One thing I really like about this movie that I don't think we ever saw in this franchise other than this is that the X-Men are superheroes. Like, I don't think they ever really got to that status. So much so that Xavier has a direct line to the president.
Yeah, the X-Phone.
X-Phone, yeah. So, like, they're on, you know, people's goodwill, the trust of the government after everything that they've, you know, saved the world a few times. Right. And their costumes look great. This is, other than the teases we get in some of the movies, as far as the costumes they wear throughout the movie, I think this is the best one. Dark Phoenix has the best costumes. It's certainly better than all those black leathers from the original series.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, I like the costumes at the end of First Class, but we don't see them till the end. And those costumes are very similar to what we're seeing here.
Right. These just with the go yellow for the full X. Yeah. So, yeah, these are cool. There's a little bit of new X-Men going on here with the suits, but making it the blue and the gold instead of the black. They gave us that tease of, like, the 90s-esque costumes at the end of Apocalypse. But for whatever reason, they opted not to use those.
I probably would have preferred. You know, what I like about this costume at the end of Apocalypse is that they're all individual. Like they don't look like, which I know it's a uniform. I guess they're supposed to be kind of all the same. But I feel like there was enough design wise to link them all together to show that they're a team, but still have, you know, individual traits. Just like the comics, you know, like Cyclops having that sort of diagonal sash on his costume. I don't know what to call it. But you gotta make them all look the same. This is a cool way to do it.
Yeah, this is a good way to do it. Like I said, you gave us the tease, which, like I said, that was when they started showing the costumes for this. I was like, but you had the good ones. What happened? But but yeah, they look good. They don't look as homogenized as like the black leather, because the black leather variations were so minimal and they were all mostly aesthetic. They may as well all been wearing the same thing. I know X3, they kind of give them all the different color highlights, but even still, it's so minor. With this, at the very least, we've got the X on the uniforms. It's bright yellow. We've got the blue on the rest of it. So yeah, they're in uniforms. It's a little homogenized, but it feels way more like the X-Men than anything else to this point.
We see when they get back from that space rescue at the airport where they land that there's a Mystique action figure. So there's X-Men merchandise. Curious if they're profiting off of that.
Hey, you got to wonder. You got to think there's a likeness for that.
There's a kid with blue face paint, which I don't know if he's a big Mystique fan, Nightcrawler fan, Beast fan. Beast who knows? Because they're all freaking blue. I wonder if that really flies in the X-Men universe. Do you think
is that offensive?
It's not for me to say, Andrew. That's not my place to say.
I always like when movies have things like that where they reveal there's merchandise, because this is one that but like in Ghostbusters 2, at the beginning of the film, there is a scene where two of the Ghostbusters dance to the Ghostbusters theme song that they play on a boombox. And the implication that apparently the Ghostbusters were so popular in the film universe that somebody wrote a song about them is hilarious to me.
But
in this tour, it's like there's action figures and stuff like that. It's always like, yeah, because at the beginning of this film, they are like almost celebrities, though. So it makes some sense that they would have this, because, like I said, the president calls them, hey, our space shuttle is doomed. Can you help us? And it is cool to see, because, like I said, to this point, they've not really gotten to that point. And I do kind of appreciate that the film just starts that way. Like, it doesn't there was no big, like, now we appreciate the mutants and view them as superheroes moment. It was just like, we're already there. And I'm like, cool. I don't need you to spend another movie showing me them being established as superheroes. So sometimes less is more. And in this case, I appreciated that.
That space shuttle rescue is really the first big action set piece that we get. And again, it looks great. I'm going to be saying that over and over again, because this movie overall looks very, very good.
Yep.
I'm a sucker for any movies in space, any space action scenes. It's always cool. Like, I love the silence of being in the vacuum of space. I love when they get to the shuttle, it's like spinning out of control. And, you know, it would... like, that's dangerous in space. They would do that forever. I don't know. Something about it, it's just different than what you see on Earth. The obvious. It's just such a unique setup for an action set piece that I think always looks good. And I don't need someone to come in and say technically, you know, in real life, this isn't exactly how that would work. I don't know if they're being accurate, if you will, but it's exciting, damn it. And I like it.
I'm not watching this particular movie to critique the science of this space shuttle. There's a whole lot of sequences here where Nightcrawler poofs out into space with just a helmet on and his hands are still exposed. And I'm like, you're not in a spacesuit, but I don't care, because it's the X-Men. I'm not paying that close of attention to it.
And again, just like the train sequence, just like a lot of action sequence, every character gets something to do. Because I'll be honest, when they're going into space in the Blackbird, which the Blackbird go into space, I'm looking at Quicksilver on the space shuttle, and I'm like,
what are you going
to
do here?
Why do you just want to go run fast in space? However, they use them. Nightcrawler teleports him onto the shuttle, and to rescue all the astronauts, he can very quickly undo all of their seatbelts and launch them out. So Nightcrawler can grab them and teleport them back. Mystique is sort of the leader here. She's calling out all the shots and making the decisions. I love that Cyclops has a built-in turret on the Blackbird. It reminds me a lot of the Millennium Falcon, how they've got those turrets on the top and bottom. He kind of drops down in this special place that puts his eyes up to this visor. It's almost like a periscope. Yep. And he can now blast out of the spaceship. That's so cool. I don't know if that's from the comics. I don't know if I've ever seen before, but it was super rad.
It feels like there was a deliberate attempt by Kinberg to make sure that everybody had something to do in the action sequences, which I think is, it just feels that way, because every single one, even the street crossing scene later, which is pretty funny, that whole action sequence is about them trying to get across the street into a house. That's the same way. Everybody gets a moment, everybody gets something to do. We're making sure that all of these characters are having a part to play. And we're making sure that nobody's, and it doesn't feel super forced either. Like, it doesn't, doesn't really have an issue with that. So
I mean, that's the most important thing in a team super movie, in my opinion, is to make sure they all have a reason for being there, have a purpose, whether it's story-wise or in these action set pieces. It's something that the Fantastic Four movies do really well. The X-Men movies have struggled with, but I think they nail it in this movie.
Right. And especially with a sizable group of them too. You've got like, I mean, on that rescue mission into space, that's Nightcrawler, Storm, Quicksilver, Cyclops. It's all of them. So finding a place for them all to fit in that doesn't feel super forced, it's an accomplishment. It should be acknowledged. And this is me acknowledging it.
I'm acknowledging you acknowledging it.
Excellent.
You know, other than action scenes, there's a lot of stuff that I think Simon Kinberg needs to get credit for. A lot of good dialogue, some funny dialogue. I really like whenever Jean Grey gets back from absorbing the Phoenix Force and Beast is doing tests on her, trying to figure out what's going on. And he says, "You're off the charts." And she says, "Well, what does that mean?" He says, "We'll have to build a better machine." It's good.
Yeah, but there's the Quicksilver quips in this one. He's a little bit more dialed back. We don't really get a sequence set to an iconic pop song in this one for Quicksilver, which shame. I'm fine with. Well, like we got two of them. They were good, but I'm okay.
Then Andrew, you know what's better than two of them?
Three of them.
No, you're right. I mean, as big as the Apocalypse one was, like, how do you top that? You
right. Can't. He just saved the entire school from being blown up. He does it to the entire planet. The planet's blowing up, so he throws up everybody. But he gets some good quips. Yeah, he kind of really gets the team dynamic. They feel like a team generally. Like, you've got the Beast, Raven, Xavier up at the top with their internal quibbles. But the rest of them, it feels like there's a chemistry, like they're a group.
Yeah, and you can introduce mutants and show mutants we haven't seen before without forcing them to be on the team. For example, we finally get Dazzler, which the series has finally been trying to do for a long time. But she's not on the team. She's not fighting, which I don't know. She's not really known for fighting anyway. But she is performing at the school after the rescue. And if you know who Dazzler is, you know it's Dazzler. I don't think they ever say her name. It looks great. You get a cool Dazzler sequence. For any Dazzler fans out there, like, you got what you wanted. And again, it's not forced into the movie where you have to have this character on the team and stick around for action scenes that they have no part in, but it's there for the fans. It's done well.
Yeah, I agree.
Also at that party, Cyclops walks up to Storm and he's like, "Hey, can you help me out?" And she makes ice cubes to drop into his drink, which is something I would expect Iceman to do, but he's not in here. And Andrew, is that something that Storm can do? I always think of Storm as being able to manipulate the weather, but can she manipulate the weather in front of her hand to freeze it into a cube?
If you take the moisture in the air and turn it back into water and then drop the temperature.
I can understand her making it hail, but making cubes in her hand is just so specific.
It's just the lower level. Because if you're creating a storm cloud, you're manipulating the atmosphere.
Like, okay, can she do everything Iceman can do? Is Iceman just a fraction?
I would say no. I would say that she can't create ice paths and blast ice at people.
Why not? But she can make an ice cube. She can't make a bridge.
No, the bridge is a lot more work. It's way easier to shoot lightning. Let me rephrase this. Could she do it? Yes, probably. Is it efficient to do it? Probably not.
It's not efficient to do it.
If you're in the middle of a crisis, yes, because Iceman creates it naturally. Ice is his thing. That's all he does. It's like the Flash. The Flash has to be faster than Superman. Otherwise, what's the point?
That's what I'm getting at here. Iceman
is
better at ice than Storm.
Yes, than Storm is.
Okay. Glad we settled that.
All right.
At one point,
the real conversations here, folks.
At one point, Xavier says, some people call us superheroes. I must confess, I don't really know what that means. We got you covered, Xavier. Listen to Men in Black 2 episode. But I think we defined superheroes pretty well.
I think we did pretty well, yeah. we'll send that over to McAvoy's agent.
You know, at Mystique's funeral, it is raining. Like, it is in 99% of movies. And as a youngster, I remember distinctly thinking, I was like, you know, if I ever made movies, because we all thought that in our head, like, sure, I'm going to have a funeral and it's not going to rain. But now I have seen that in a movie before, and it's very strange. And I kind of understand now. I've grown as a person and as a film enthusiast. Like, movies are a visual medium, and you're using the entire frame to create an emotion, and gray clouds and rain creates a feeling of sadness. And that's why it always rains at a funeral. So again, if you are like young me and you're like, why is it always rain at funerals? You're just watching the movie wrong. Just going, you know, getting your feels a little bit. That's the whole point.
It's the visual language. You're trying to, like I said, it's no different than when you look outside and it's overcast and nasty and you just feel lesser. It's the same idea. You're trying to invoke a visual imagery.
You play Sea Change by Beck and you cry. And
I do that every day, to be fair.
We mentioned already, but Michael Fassbender comes in a little late in the movie, 52 minutes in. But once he's there, and it's like he was never gone.
Right.
I love that scene at his, I guess it's an island, Genosha. And because Jean Grey arrives there, she attracts the military, and these helicopters arrive. And kudos. I mean, you know, Nicholas Holt gets our Mark Strong Award, but Sophie Turner and Michael Fassbender acting like they are fighting for control of this helicopter. They both have their arms outstretched in front of them. Their arms are shaking and they're crunching their face up. Because you know, on set, that has to look hilarious. Like, it looks cool with those special effects. You know what's going on. But otherwise, just putting that much into it is pretty funny.
Yep. I love the scene at the end with Eric and Charles, where they kind of like meet at this restaurant, and like Charles is feeling very defeated, I guess, in the aftermath of what's happened, because they've lost Raven. They've lost now, assumedly, Jean, and they've named the school after her, but he's feeling very, I guess, kind of dejected, lost. And Eric finds him and basically is like, years ago, you saved me and offered me a home. And now I want to do the same for you. And then they play the game of chess, which brings this kind of, in a way, whether we, you know, back to the beginning with the idea of Charles and Eric playing chess. And I think even if this wasn't necessarily designed as like the cap, it's a cool, nice moment to end it on. And what's interesting to me too is there is nothing in these credits. There is nothing at the end of these credits. There is no teases. There's no anything. So again, maybe they took some out. I don't know, because by the time this came out, Disney was certainly fully in control and they would have known. But it ends up having a weird finality to it without even necessarily intending it. Because obviously the idea also is, you know, Jean's not gone. She always comes back. That's the point. But
yeah, I mean, it does pan up to the sky and you see a phoenix.
We do see the phoenix in the sky. So, but
you could, I don't really look at that as a tease for a sequel, though. It's just sort of like Jean is okay.
She's out there.
Or will be okay. She's out there. And she's the phoenix. That's, you know, always comes back. That's the whole idea.
But yeah, there's no overt drops or teases.
Yeah, no post credits. Yeah.
No post credits, no mid credits, no anything. So it does end up, and like I said, I imagine by the time this came out, they probably knew that this was the end for the X-Men. So like, you probably, if there was anything planned, they probably cut it, or if there was something, I don't know, but curious about that. I didn't think to look for that to see if there were credit teases. I know this was originally intended as potentially a two-part film.
And then potentially a trilogy where it's all these younger X-Men take over as the
right. So
the center. So
there were plans. They did not come to pass. This, like I said, this is the last X-Men movie. We get one more Foxverse movie after this with New Mutants, which come back soon, folks. but yeah, I do like that ending. Like I said, intentional or not, it does give us a nice little bookend, because these movies always are kind of about Charles and Eric. So to just bring that around and kind of show them still looking out for each other after, I mean, almost 20 years of films.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't think of it like that, but it is a very good, if this is the last X-Men movie, it's a great place to end it, story-wise and visually. You're right, there's not a lot of teases for future movies to come or anything, which of course they never will. I do like the last scene at the cafe. They're sort of eating outdoors at a cafe. I was just waiting for Charles to look up and see Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle and just nod at him. But it's very good. The two of them playing chess. Yeah. I love the reverse where now it's Magneto trying to look out for Xavier and pick him up and return the favor. It's very nice. They're very fitting into those two characters for sure. You mentioned earlier the action scene where they're just trying to cross the street.
Yes.
Which is a funny way to look at it. But Jean Grey is in this house with with Vuk, and Xavier's trying to get to her to save her. Magneto's trying to get to her to destroy her, and they clash at this street. And the entire set piece, the entire action set, the big action set piece, is just in this very unassuming street.
Crowded street. Like they pull it's a lot. Like he pulls a train out of the friggin' ground, like,
which is awesome. A great Magneto. Way
awesome. Yeah. That now is awesome. But like
I don't know why he did it, other than it's awesome, because there's buses and cars everywhere. He could have used any one of them, but it's just, I think it's a bit of a flex. Like, you know what? I'm going to pull this subway car out through the ground, and it's
match
pretty rad.
It's pretty, like, Magneto, like, really, like, they really try to find some cool stuff for him to do in this movie, and they succeed. He comes off very cool in this movie. Like, he looks awesome. And I love that sequence. Is, like I said, it's funny to look at it as we're trying to cross the street, but it's a very dangerous street. But yeah, it's again, it's another sequence where we've got the end of this film on the train is basically Magneto's Brotherhood-esque group. I don't know if they're ever actually called that.
I don't think I don't think we learn any of their names, to be honest with you. We understand their powers.
One's kind of like Charles, has mental control, and the other one has his whip hair. And those are the only two I think we get. But either way, we have this big clash with the X-Men, which is basically Storm, Nightcrawler, Cyclops, and Xavier versus Magneto, Beast, and these two people from Magneto's Genosha. And it's a cool scene. I mean, like I said, they're fighting. Everybody's kind of matched up, and we get interesting scenarios. And it's just cool. It's, like I said, it's very contained. So it's a large-scale action sequence on a very small-scale location. But they, like I said, they make the most out of all the action sequences in this movie.
Yeah. And once they get in the house, it's still rad. So like Magneto, he's like as powerful as ever, or the most powerful he's ever been throughout this movie. But when he goes up against the Phoenix Force, he's nothing. He's
got nothing.
Yeah. And whenever she like crushes his helmet and squeezing on his head, you like, it's visceral. You're like,
I almost thought that was the end. Like, I really thought they were going to
pushes it
like,
far.
I legit was like, are you really going to go there? Like, are you really going to do this? Obviously, they did. I don't know why. She just breaks the helmet apart right after that and launches him out of the house. And I'm like you had him. But
Michael Fassbender.
You can't do that. Look at that face. You can't do that. He gets to look really cool. He gets to do some really cool stuff. And like I said, Jean is portrayed as I'm trying to think of the term I'm thinking of, but just an unstoppable force.
God.
Like they don't mince words about how powerful the Phoenix is, and they show it. It's basically nobody can stand up to her, basically. The only person that can stand up to Jean is Jean, basically.
And then Charles gets in the house, and you know, we're talking about great acting with Sophie Turner and Michael Fassbender controlling the helicopter. Jean Grey makes Charles Xavier walk. And again, you got to think about James McAvoy on set acting like a paralyzed person who's being forced to walk. And he's walking like a newborn deer, like his legs are all shaking and stuff. In the moment, I'm taking it seriously. But if you pull yourself out a little bit, you're like, this is a little ridiculous.
Well, he sells it.
He's a professional. Yeah. But I like the end of this conflict because the Dabari's gotten into her head, and like, these people don't care about you. You're above them. They need to be destroyed. Like, she's totally on their side, and she's upset with Xavier for lying to her about her parents and the fact that her dad's still alive. And I love their ending resolution because Charles doesn't try to force anything. I mean, he's powerless too at this point. She's so powerful, and he just lets her in his mind. He's like, I'm not going to stop you. Just go in my head. Like, you'll see. And she does so and realizes that all the decisions he made were out of love and that he cared about her. Even if they were misguided, he's never had any ill will towards her. And I just think that it's just such an Xavier way to win that conflict, to be like, I'm not going to fight you. I'm going to be totally vulnerable. And I just trust that you're going to make the right decision. And of course, it's a big lesson for him to learn, because he had been manipulating her throughout her life, blocking those memories and make a lot of bad decisions. But he's learning from that and doing a very Charles Xavier thing, where being like, look, I love you and you do what you have to do. And you trust that she makes the right decision. And eventually she does.
It's very, like you said, it's very Charles Xavier way of resolving that, because what it does is it flashes back to the decision where Charles is speaking to her father and wants her to come stay at the school. And her dad says she's a lost cause. And Xavier's like, no, nobody's a lost cause.
Yep.
Not as long as we have hope. And so it's, and that kind of shows her that, you know, misguided as it was, Charles was trying to watch out for her because her father believed she was a lost cause. And he's like, no, I refuse to believe that.
Yep. His line was, as long as there's someone who cares for her, who believes in her, there's still hope. And he holds true to that to the end.
Yep. Absolutely.
One last thing about this action set piece, just going back to Nightcrawler being a bit of a pacifist, and he's forced to fight in this scene. And at the end of the action scene, he asks him, Kurt, you all right? And he says, no.
Yeah.
You know, we've been calling this movie Dark Phoenix, which is what it's called, but I kind of respected that, like the marketing and stuff, like the poster, the trailers, and the movie itself. It just is called Dark Phoenix, not X-Men. Dark Phoenix. They put a little circle around the X to kind of hint, you know, that it's a Dark Phoenix.
I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Well, obviously we're all going to know, but you know, it's rare for a studio to have like that much faith in an audience. They want, you know, X-Men to brand, put it on the posters. And to be fair, internationally, it had the X-Men name on it. And then once it didn't do so well at the box office, on the home video release, they put X-Men on the cover. But that original poster, which I think is pretty rad, it gets, you know, it's got the blue and orange thing that people love to criticize, but it's not a generic face poster. It's not generic at all. I think it's pretty cool. It's got the whole portrait style of all the team. It looks great. Anyway, what I'm getting at is I appreciate the studio having faith to be able to just call the movie Dark Phoenix.
Take some balls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
For lack of a better way to put it, like really to genuinely be like, we're going to make an X-Men movie and not put X-Men in the title. Like it would have been like a releasing Avengers as just Infinity War, which again, I'm sure you could have done.
Yeah.
But they didn't. It was still Avengers Infinity War. But yeah, it's odd because this movie I think once they knew it was a Disney movie, they made some changes to make it a little bit more self-contained. But looking at certain pieces of this, you can clearly see that there were intentions. Like obviously, Kimberg has said multiple times that he saw this as the first in a new trilogy of just these characters, kind of moving away from the past and just giving us these people. And then again, this movie was supposed to be two parts and it got condensed to one. And Kinberg has said that if he got to do the two-part version, he would have included Lalandra and the Hellfire Club and stuff like that. So it ends up being kind of odd that you see these things that feel like we're really trying to transition this film to this new cast and then ultimately it doesn't get to happen. But having faith in the title alone, that's you got some belief that this is going to catch on. If you're just gonna be like Dark Phoenix, like you couldn't, the last one just being called Apocalypse would have been weird, like it would have been strange. But like with this one, it is the right kind of title that I think in a better scenario it absolutely would have worked. I think you could have done it.
Now I'm glad they put X-Men on the Blu-ray, because that would be very frustrating to have on your shelf. Suddenly have one movie that's totally, or because everybody categorizes the Blu-rays alphabetically, right? That's not just a movie. Everybody does that, right?
Yeah.
If you don't do that, you're an animal.
bestrestpod@gmail.com.
You write into us and I want to hear from you in your madness.
But one thing I do that's strange though, I have, you can see behind me, you folks can't see, but I have my shelves there that have my movies, but on the one, I have all my movies and they are alphabetical. But on the other one, I have all my Criterions and they're numerical.
Well, that's just they're numerical. You keep them.
Yeah.
But you're never going to like complete that collection.
No. Just fun.
All right. I'll let the people judge you.
There's no way I'm getting all 1,000 Criterions. So no, absolutely not.
In the Fox logo, most of the X-Men movies, definitely the original ones, it shows 20th Century Fox, and as it fades away, the X stays lit just a little bit longer. And then they stop doing that for a while. They don't do it in First Class. I don't think they did it in Days of Future Past. They bring it back here, and not only does the X stick around, but it lights on fire.
Yeah, it's got a cool little look to it the whole time. Like, it's not just at the end. Yeah. It's like that for the whole thing. So,
yeah. Of course, representing cool that 20th Century Fox is on fire and being destroyed by Disney. That's...
Yes. That's... was that not the intended imagery? I do want to bring attention. We mentioned it a couple of times, but that scene in the kitchen with Xavier and Beast is just so good. That's basically right after Raven's funeral, where Jean has basically unleashed, inadvertently killed Raven, and is now on the run. And Raven has been, they've just had her funeral. Quicksilver is out of commission. So, like, the team is kind of in a bad place. And it shakes Hank's faith in Xavier's greater plan, basically. He's like, he kind of loses faith in him. And the thing is, he wants him to admit that he was wrong, and he won't do it. He still insists that he won't. And that kind of arrogance of Xavier is definitely a thing in the comics at times. He definitely has that belief that I'm doing the best that I can. And if something goes wrong, it's unfortunate, but it's not because I made a bad decision. So that becomes the tension between them and what leads to Beast going to Magneto and saying, we need to do this. Because even Magneto even tells Beast straight up, if we find her, I'm going to kill her. And Beast is like, I know. And he's not at all deterred. But no, like I said, we obviously mentioned Holt several times, but I just really want to call out that scene. It's not very long, but just really sells the tension and really kind of makes you buy that Hank has completely lost faith in this man. He has no belief that he's doing the right thing anymore. So it's just really, really good.
Well, speaking of that being true to Xavier of the comics, let me ask you this. We like to ask in these episodes, you specifically, Mr. Comic Book Expert, how the movie functions as an adaptation. But I want to ask you this specifically because Simon Kinberg went on record to say that X3, he wasn't super happy with how it came out, especially with in relation to adapting the Phoenix. And he wanted to kind of right that wrong with this movie. So, do you think Dark Phoenix is a better adaptation of the Phoenix story than X-Men 3?
Is it better? Yes.
Okay, so we succeeded at least in that goal to have right. a better adaptation. Obviously, when you streamline stuff for films, there's always concessions, but do you think he kept true to the spirit of the original story? Is there still too much missing? What's your summation of that?
I think if you're going to do Dark Phoenix as one film, and kind of not have any real build. I know Apocalypse kind of hints at it, but I don't think this is being done like disrespectfully. I think the problem is
to be fair, the hints in Apocalypse no longer make any sense in
right
this
because the hints in Apocalypse are similar to the hints in X2, where like we're implying the Phoenix is already in there,
right?
So. We're already working against that by having the external force inhabit Jean in this film and then kind of going from there. But I think he was doing his best. I don't think any of this was done disrespectfully. I think the problem at large with a Dark Phoenix story is it really is just too big for one movie. I think this is something you really do need to build up to. And in both instances, it just kind of felt like there was this one-off tease and then bam, Phoenix. Now in X2 to X3, the bigger problem is that there's really no focus on the Phoenix whatsoever. In X3, like I said, we both look back favorably at it saying, hey, this is a lot better than you probably remember it being. But the Phoenix story is given kind of the backseat in its own film.
Yeah.
Basically, Jean is already the Phoenix. This thing is already inside of her. And she just kind of becomes this aside to Magneto on his quest to stop the mutant cure. Now, that movie, I think, really didn't need to dedicate to which one it wanted to tell. I think go with one or the other, and you would have been in a better position. But with this, it's 100% focused on Dark Phoenix. We're given the Phoenix setup right at the beginning. Deep end, no floaties. I respect that always. When you trust the audience, just kind of go with it.
Emerald Energy of Willpower.
Emerald Energy of Will. I think I like I said, I don't think it was disrespectful. I think he was trying to take it all, condense it down, strip away as much as he could for the sake of a film, which is why we kind of have some more generic aliens with the Dabari versus something like the Shi'ar or anybody like that coming in. But if you're going to do it as one film, I think this is really kind of you'd land in the ballpark of this. I just think generally it's like Infinity War. You couldn't start with Infinity War. You had to build to that. You had to give it the seeds and build up to that. And I think Dark Phoenix is just something that's kind of like that. You need to get all those pieces in play before you blow up with Dark Phoenix. But if you're going to do it in one shot, I think this is a much more consistent attempt. The focus, obviously, throughout this whole movie is on Jean and the Phoenix. We're not really sidetracked by anything else. The focus in this movie is completely on that. And I think, I mean, if you read the Dark Phoenix saga by Chris Claremont, and it's not gonna be this. But I think taking that concept, trying to streamline it for film, you're going to land here. And I think he's doing as respectful a job as he can.
Yeah, you're right. It would take more than one movie. I've got the the 90s animated series, X-Men series, which is fantastic. Yeah. I have those DVDs, and just looking at like the episode listing, I'm pretty sure the Phoenix Saga is like 7 or 8 episodes. Like, it's a lot. Now, granted, mm-hmm. those are 20-minute episodes. Runtime might equal what we have here, but still, it takes its time telling the story because it's so expansive and so long. But okay, that's fair enough. If you're going to do it in one movie, this might be about it. You know, I think that does it for us for this week for discussing this movie. I will say that I straight up like this movie. I'm not going to say it's the best X-Men movie, but
right.
well above, I think, that critic score. And I mean, it's far from the worst. Hashtag positivity podcast.
Not the lowest of this franchise.
I'll say right now, I like it more than Apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I don't know. Maybe in the future we can rank all of these movies. I mean, we're almost,
well, like I said, there is one more to talk about. So
have you seen The New Mutants? You ever watched that one?
I have not.
I have not either.
I've somehow, like, it's like it came and it went, like it just it. And then that was another one where I'm not going to say, I'm typically a kind of person that's like, the reviews are one thing, but I need to see for myself. But like, I saw the reviews for New Mutants and was legit like, I'm in no rush to watch this.
Yeah. It doesn't help that it came out in the middle of the pandemic and I didn't want to go to a movie theater anyway, but I do own it. I just haven't watched it, but like I said, we probably will soon. And maybe once we watch that last movie, we can rank all these things. We can try to figure out our order.
We got.
Put a cap on this thing.
Put a cap on the Foxverse, as it were.
Now, one thing I always ask you to do is to kindly leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And you know what? Go one step farther. Leave a review for every podcast that you listen to regularly. It's quick. It's easy. It's fun. It's free. And if you leave a review for our show specifically, we are going to read it on an episode. Now, Andrew, we make it a point whenever we talk about movies, because of our premise, because we're a hashtag positivity podcast, we never call a movie bad. In the intro, I always refer to, you know, we're talking about poorly received comic book movies, but we never use the word bad. There's not bad movies. Now, with that in mind, we got a new review I would like you to read.
All right. This review, That Guy in Doom, 5 stars, September 2nd, 2021. Amazing. I always love bad movies, and these guys make me feel better knowing there are good parts to the movies I enjoy. Just because a movie is bad doesn't mean you need to feel bad for liking it, because all movies have greatness. Can't wait for Venom or Batman v Superman, The Birth and Death of Doomsday. I mean, Justice.
Very funny. And you know what? You can make us use the word bad by leaving a review, because we have to read whatever you put in that review. But thank you for the review, That Guy in Doom. And by now, you should have heard Venom, Batman versus Superman. You will hear very soon.
Soon.
And always remember, if there is a superhero movie that you like that was poorly received upon release, we want to know what you like about it. Tell us the best performance in the movie. Who's your Mark Strong Award winner? What's the best scene? You can always send us an email, bestoftherestpod@gmail.com. Or you can join our Discord. Check the episode description for your invitation. If you've never been on Discord before, I encourage you just to jump in there. It's just a great place for communities of people to get together. You can hang out with fellow listeners of the show. You can talk directly to myself and Andrew. And there is a channel in that Discord for you to submit your thoughts on future movies. So, for example, you know Batman versus Superman is coming. You can jump in that channel, tell us your thoughts, tell us your favorite scene, tell us your best performance. And when we record that episode, we are going to read your thoughts on air, whatever you put in there, as long as it's positive. Because, again, hashtag positivity podcast. And remember, maybe not every movie is great,
but all movies have greatness.
Thank you to Mark Benavides for singing our theme song. Follow him on Instagram at NotThatMarkAnthony. Thank you to Mitch of Depressed to Impress for the music. Check him out on YouTube and Twitch.tv. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. It's the only way we're going to grow. And follow us on social media at BOTRcast. Thank you. I was looking into some other things that she's done or will do, going through her filmography. Nothing too big that I had heard of, but supposedly she's going to be in a movie in the future called Father of the Bride Part 3-ish.
That's already out.
It's out?
Yeah. It's a short film. It's not. Yeah, it's out there.
What? Well, then I'll probably cut that because it's not as fun.
No.
Are you sure?
It's literally listed as 2020. Like, that's the year on the filmographies.
Well, then, this isn't a fun story.
No, it's not.
People already know about it.
Yeah. I got to be honest, Chris. I'm disappointed.
Is it a real movie? Is it any good?
It's a short film. It's a short film. It's not very long.
It's like a web YouTube thing?
Yeah. Like, it's all the cast from the first two movies comes back.
Through Netflix. Yeah, that's boring. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a fun anecdote.
Nope, not at all.
Good accent, though.
Good accent, though.